justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Okay. All right. Hey, hello, everybody. Nice to see you. So my name is Astra Taylor. I am one of the co-founders of The Debt Collective and a writer and filmmaker.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lindsay Muniak. I am an organizer with The Debt Collective focusing on medical debt. That wonderful, wonderful thing we have in the U.S. And really, really happy to be here with you all.
And hi, everyone. I'm really happy to be back at Socialism Conference. I've already heard a lot of good panels. My name is Renee Moya. I'm a tenant organizer based out of Los Angeles. I've been with the Debt Collective now for almost 2 years, which is fantastic. And again, I'm here because I love landlords. So.
We got jokes at the Debt Collective as well. So we're going to start off with some big picture. So like, why debt? You know, we're here at the Socialism Conference. Why are we talking about debt? And we're going to go ahead and start off with Astra. So Astra's going to speak for about 10 minutes, and then we're going to open it up for just two questions, and we're going to kind of proceed that way throughout.
I'm feeling kind of shamed as the co-founder with my like really messy chicken scratch, and they all have these really nice presentations. Why debt? And the simple answer is that it's a form of power. It's a power in a twofold sense. So one, it's power over us. It's a source of domination. Debt is a disciplinary force, and it's long been recognized by that. There was a recent academic study last year that showed a strong correlation internationally between rising household indebtedness and lessening strikes. Right? We, you know, we work. We are more afraid of losing our jobs when we have bills that we need to pay, and we're afraid of our credit score plummeting and the consequences of that. So debt is power over us. But debt is also power for us. And this, I think, is the key reframing and transformative insight, and really the insight that has kept me going with this work for now over a decade, which is a bit mind-boggling. Debt, your debt is somebody else's asset. It is on somebody's books. Now, under the form of the economic formation we're living in, that can be the state, it can be a corporation, you know, it could be a bank, it could be a hospital, like a nonprofit. Your debt can be held by all sorts of entities, but it's an asset. And we have power in recognizing that fact and withholding our debt strategically or building political strategies around that. So that is one of our catchphrases. The Debt Collective has a lot of slogans, a lot of memes. And your debt is someone else's asset is a big one. I think that's a really core insight. And it's, you know, even before we managed to win debt cancellation, debt abolition, even just the recognition of that fact, right, that you're in debt because it's profitable to someone else is actually a form of empowerment. Debt is not neutral. And this is a really old thing. So one thing that I find really interesting is that debt is older than capitalism. Debt is ancient. It's a kind of ancient, brutal form of domination. I was writing a book about democracy, making a film about democracy, and I was so interested to learn that many of the ancient movements that sparked sort of proto-democratic revolts and social changes in ancient Greece and ancient Rome were debtors' revolts, where people were being forced into debt peonage and rose up. And that was actually sort of the beginning of ancient democratic Athens and the Roman Republic. So, you know, we thought we were developing this new thing by leading a debtors' movement, but there's kind of nothing new under the sun. And debtors' revolts were actually very, very, very common in the colonial era. And there, it was a big concern of the founding fathers who despised debtors and the quote-unquote wicked project of debt abolition, because they were indebted tenant farmers who were resisting their debts and then actually taking over state legislatures and writing in debt relief and stuff like that. So we are part of a long tradition, but something has changed. So I think the Debt Collective is very attuned to both continuity and change. And something has changed. So debt has long been a form of control around the world, but also in the United States. You know, but something did happen in the late 70s, what we call financialization or neoliberalism. You know, to radically simplify and lose nuance, we sort of went from a quasi-welfare state, a welfare state that was, of course, not sufficient, into a debt-fare state, right? So in the early, you know, in the mid-60s, if you went to a state college, you could go without paying tuition, without taking on debt. That is no longer the case, right? State investment has gone down, and tuition and debt have filled the gap. So we are increasingly having to debt finance our basic needs. And our communities also have to debt finance basic needs, right? We have to issue bonds to raise money for schools and infrastructure and hospitals and all sorts of stuff. So debt has become increasingly central to the economy. Debt was always there, but it's much more central to the economic reality that we are in today. And that's why we have to pay attention to it. We can't afford not to pay attention to it because we live in a financialized economy. And that's just the fact. Now, discussions about financialization and neoliberalism can seem kind of abstract, highfalutin. And one of our other slogans or mottos is the age of financialization is experienced as the age of debt, right? Like, your debt is neoliberalism. That's where it touches your lives. It's actually not a complicated idea that only economists can understand. We're all living it every day when we have to borrow money to meet our basic needs. And so this debt, you know, is pervasive, right? We all are either in debt, know people who have debt. It's a mass phenomenon. I do want to say, though, that even if you do not personally have debt, this movement is for you, because precisely that, you live in a community that's probably issuing bonds for schools, which means it's paying money to Wall Street. You're probably, you know, your life has probably been constrained in some way by your desire to avoid debt. You know, this is a movement for debtors and their allies. And so I just think that that's really critical to highlight. And living in a world where huge numbers of people are indebted and stressed, you know, affects all of us. So this isn't a movement just for debtors. Debtor organizing, one thing that's kept me with it too as well, is that it's a complementary analysis. It really adds, I think, to the left as a whole and to the socialist project as a whole. Debtor organizing is a matter of racial justice. If you look at the history of the United States, debt has been a tool of racial domination and control. Think about sharecropping after emancipation. Think about redlining. Debt has always been racialized. We see this in the statistics. It's clear as day. Debt is a matter of gender justice. The people who hold the most student debt, for example, are Black women. Payday lenders target Black mothers particularly because they know that if it's the choice between, you know, being on the street with your kids or taking out a predatory payday loan at 400% interest, you're going to do that. You're vulnerable to that. It's a matter of disability justice. Disabled people also carry huge loads of debt. It's a matter of labor justice because we are robbed twice. We're robbed at the job when we're paid low wages, and we're robbed by the lenders who then benefit from those low wages because we have to borrow to provide for our basic needs. It's a matter of democracy because debt at the, again, these bonds or at the municipal level, the state level, the national or sovereign level, has a way of taking precedent over democratic needs. Like, oh, you got to pay back those debts, so your country can't have healthcare, right? So it's a matter of democracy, and it's a matter of ecological survival, because the fundamental nature of debt is to charge interest, which means it is locking in the logic of endless growth, right? It's saying you're going to pay back more tomorrow than you have today, and so you're going to have to keep growing the economy and exploiting labor and land ever more intensely and violently. So that's kind of some big picture ideas. Very quick summary of where the Debt Collective came from. Occupy Wall Street. Yes, indeed. We were born at Zuccotti Park. David Graeber, who some of you may know, was a pal of mine and started kind of instigating a kind of working group to start talking about debt and possible strategies before he moved back to the UK. And we, went, you know, it's just born of the recognition that everyone at the parks, everyone at the encampments, not only in the U.S., but all over the world, were in debt. And it was the first place where I ever said my debt publicly, aloud to other people. And I had this moment where I just thought I was in the worst situation in the world. I just defaulted my student loans. And I was like, oh, my God, my situation's not even that bad. right? Like, I don't even have medical debt. I'm not underwater on a mortgage. And we started, it just felt like, wow, there's something here. We're leaving power on the table. We need to figure out how to channel this into something that's lasting. It's something that was more lasting than a fleeting occupation, right? We were also of the mindset that we knew Occupy wouldn't last. We wanted to build something lasting out of that. We began organizing around different things. We started something called the Rolling Jubilee, kind of as an experiment to demonstrate that if the government could bail out the banks, it could hypothetically bail out debtors. So we started bailing out debtors by buying debts on the predatory secondary debt market, erasing a couple $1 million of medical debt here or there. But we always knew we had to organize our way out of the crisis. We couldn't buy our way out of the crisis. One of our colleagues, collaborators, Thomas Gokey, I was like, okay, this is all interesting. We're kind of doing hijinks. Like, we have a great analysis, but what are we doing? And he said, you know what we need? We need a debtors union. And this light bulb went off in my mind. And I was like, that's brilliant. Someone else should do that. And it turns out the someone else was me. And it was the other people who got involved, right? The someone else is always us. If we want to see a good idea, we have to do it. So we bought a portfolio of debt attached to a sinking predatory for-profit college, one of these colleges that serves hundreds of thousands of students and ruins their lives. Began organizing with them, launched the first ever student debt strike when Obama was president in 2015, demanded full cancellation of this particular college's debt while also starting to sound the alarm. We need a full jubilee. We need free college. We need medical debt, student debt, all of it canceled, but really digging into one campaign. And 2022, June 2022, billions and billions of dollars were finally raised across the board for 600,000 people, and we've won something like over $22 billion of debt relief for defrauded students who went to these for-profit colleges. Through a mixture of bold strikes and direct actions, policy analysis, really getting in the weeds, even in D.C., as unsavory as that is, media, communications, all this stuff. And, of course, you know, Biden, thanks to grassroots pressure and years of work, announced a debt cancellation plan that is being sabotaged. The Democrats are partly to blame. We can talk about that later. All that good stuff.
Thank you so much. Okay, so now I'm going to open it up if anybody has any questions. So just a couple questions, comments. If not, that's okay too, because we did cover a lot. But shameless plug. Hi, come on up, comrade. Any other person? So we actually have this book. We have a manifesto in the Debt Collective called Can't Pay, Won't Pay, and it's available for purchase. So we can't cover everything today, so you'll get it on this book. Hi there.
Hi. I was wondering, you were talking about Jubilee. I was wondering if... You said you were part of the Occupy Wall Street movement, or at least it started from the Occupy Wall Street. But I'm wondering if there's any movement on Jubilee 2000 or continuing Jubilee 2000 to make any movement on international debt collection or debt cancellation.
Oh, thank you for that question, because I forgot to say something I wanted to say, which is that for many of us who are sort of the originators, right, the people who founded the Debt Collective, that was our direct inspiration. So I was, 19 when the Battle of Seattle happened and started learning about the Jubilee campaign and the need for sovereign debt cancellation, right? The need for the cancellation of odious debts owed by countries, poor countries, that are essentially extracting wealth from them so they can't meet the basic needs of the citizenry. And, in 2000, it didn't really occur to me like, oh, wow, there's actually a direct correlation between the way people are living in the United States and that. So I guess I just want to say there's a direct resonance there. And we have since kind of done events and been in solidarity and do a lot of political education around that issue with some of the groups that are still working on that. I think there's a real, resonance there because it's happening at every level.
Any other questions? Awesome. And I just want to add, like, exactly like Asher was saying, that debt connects us not just to our comrades here in the United States, but all over the world, because, other countries are indebted as well. So let's pass it off to Renee. Is that okay?
Sure.
Renee's going to go ahead and talk to us a little bit about rent debt and tenant organizing.
Awesome, folks. And I'm going to try to keep it within time. I actually had prepared a really long sort of socialist analysis of the housing market. I'm not going to do that entire thing, but I do think it's important to start by mentioning that, the history of like a left-wing analysis around housing is as old as like capitalism itself, right? So you had folks like Engels in particular, who in like the housing question and in the conditions of the working class in England really talked about how the working class generally always has lived through a crisis of a shortage of safe and decent housing. It's meant overcrowding and unhygienic conditions, and it's meant eviction, right? But the capitalist housing system is one that's still defined by a lot of the same processes that existed then in a very different form today, right? And they all still impact all of us in many different ways, debt being one of the central sort of drivers of that. It's still defined, for example, by booms and busts. Sometimes those booms and busts in the housing market are small or they're regional, and sometimes they're global, right? Like they were about 15 years ago. It's defined by cycles of investment, crises of overaccumulation, and also divestment, right? So what does that look like? I think all of us understand examples of this in our day-to-day life. You know, it looks like decaying urban or suburban centers through disinvestment, mass evictions, and gentrification driving a process of urban renewal through investment, right? There's sort of the flip side of the investment process. And divestment, I should also say, is necessary as a starting point for the accumulation of capital and also economic growth, right? So these cycles of like investment and divestment drive community level changes in our cities. Things that we all like are very cognizant of because we see them every single day, right? As historical examples, white flight, right? White flight was a racial capitalist process of divestment from our cities, a spatial resegregation through state-sanctioned suburbanization, right? And when we talk about gentrification today, what we're really talking about is its concrete reversal, right? It means, yes, the return of the white middle classes to our cities, but specifically, we're really talking about the refoundation of our cities as engines of economic growth, right? It's very profitable now to be once again reinvesting in our cities. For poor working class folks, especially those of color, this entails displacement from their homes, their communities, driving them into the suburbs and exurbs, or as we see a lot in the cities like the place that I come from, LA, or in Oakland, for example, homelessness. Okay, that's big picture history stuff, right? So what are the defining characteristics of the housing crisis today? What we mean by the housing crisis, really the permanent housing crisis, right? At the 30,000 foot level, we oftentimes use the term financialization, right? But I want to unpack that term a little bit because I think that we don't often talk with specificity about what we mean by that, right? Actually, in some ways, what we're really experiencing is like three different processes that are kind of interrelated. Number one, financialization. Number two, corporatization. And number three, an increasing growth in the scale of real estate actors. So let's talk about them. Financialization, what we mean by that is the increased tendency for owners and investors to value and leverage housing as a financial asset, right? In the same way that they would use stocks or bonds, right? It's no longer just your house is your house. Your house is now your little piggy bank, right? As the urban studies scholar Ben Teresa points out, this process further divorces housing from its purpose as shelter by using it to generate profits in financial markets specifically. It's a reason why, by the way, today real estate makes up 60% of all global assets, and nearly half of all global assets are specifically invested in, residential real estate, so in homes, right? So let's be clear, though, here. Financialization didn't commodify housing. Like, it didn't commodify a lot of the things that we already took for granted. Housing has been commodified under capitalism from the very beginning. But under financialization, housing is, if you will, recommodified by banks, by homeowners who leverage their equity, by landlords who package rental income streams into exotic investments, real thing that's happening or has happened, and by institutional investors who look to park their money in safe and lucrative assets. By corporatization, we mean the increased activity by corporate entities of all kinds in the housing market. So private equity, right? Blackstone. Trusts, that means family trusts, corporate trusts, you name it. Limited liability corporations, corporate landlords. These actors play an increasingly important role in our hottest housing markets, exacerbating the crisis of affordability for the poor and working class. But corporatization isn't just for the big boys, right? even when we talk about corporate landlords, we should be very clear that even smaller players have kind of taken up the mantle a little bit of their work. So what we mean by that is that corporate landlords, or rather smaller landlords, have been learning to professionalize their work through these kind of corporatized schemes. They've adopted more sophisticated tactics and strategies from the bigger players to learn how better to evict tenants. And they respond to market signals from the big corporate landlords to be able to raise our rents when they know that the corporate landlords are doing it as well. And this has political consequences. State and national landlord lobbies are almost entirely dominated by gigantic corporate landlords at the leadership level, and they provide a wealth of information to smaller players on how, again, to evict folks. And by the way, this is super important. I always like to mention this. The real estate industry in this country is literally by far the biggest lobbying like entity in the United States at the local level and at the federal level. If you ever look at moderate Democrats or essentially all Republicans and you look at who is donating to them, you will always see real estate interests are among their top donors for a reason. Finally, increased scale, right? We mean the concentration of rental units in ever larger real estate portfolios. That kind of speaks to itself. So all of these processes have only strengthened over time. So the most recent annual report by the Joint Center on Housing Studies at Harvard noted that investor purchases of single-family homes increased dramatically over the past few years, especially for lower-cost homes, and their activity was driven by the biggest investors. It also noted that rental property ownership is now moving away from individual investors, so small mom-and-pop landlords, and towards bigger business entities, right? And of course, on the construction side, there's not a lot to celebrate. Most of the housing that is being built at the national level is at the higher end of the market. In LA, there's been a net increase of about 89,000 apartments in the city of Los Angeles. 95% of them, according to CoStar, are for higher end renters. So what does this mean for all of you in the room, all of us as a society? It means that housing is more unaffordable for everyone. Moody's this year noted that for the first time since they've been tracking this data, the typical American tenant is now rent burdened. That means that they spend at least 30% of their gross income, not their net income, on rent. And it means, and by the way, in 1999 when they started this, that figure was at about 22.5%. So it's been a marked increase. The National Low-Income Housing Coalition notes that the median rents have increased by about 18% literally just in 2021. And between January of last year and June of last year, they increased by 25%. How many of you received rent increases that were a little shocking to you over the last couple of years? Yeah, you're not alone here. So pandemic rent debt protections and emergency rent relief programs, they've almost entirely disappeared with severe consequences. This shouldn't be a shock. Rent debt is by far the biggest driver of evictions. Simply put, people get evicted because they can't afford to pay their bloody rent, okay? It's therefore unsurprising that evictions are surging nationally, particularly, by the way, in the South and the Southwest, places that we oftentimes don't talk about when it comes to evictions. In many places, evictions are much higher than they were even pre-pandemic. And then, of course, homelessness, and in particular, unsheltered homelessness, which is growing. It's growing, especially among people of color, but also among seniors, actually. And this has only worsened because of the end of the tenant protections. I know that I only have about a minute left, so I'm just going to try to wrap up here. So to sum it all up, I want to use the term, the military term snafu, to kind of describe where we're at, right? It's situation under capitalism, normal, all effed up, right? That's kind of where we are. It's the same old thing, but just kind of a little bit worse than before. What do we do about it? All right, there have already been a couple of panels during the conference that have covered kind of the exciting and growing breadth of burgeoning radical tenants unions across the country. Nationally, we see the birth of tenants unions of many kinds, and they're organizing at a scale unlike anything we've seen in the United States for decades, right? From the growth of radical autonomous tenant union movements, I'm a member of one such union, of the LA Tenants Union, to the Federal Homes Guarantee Campaign for federal tenant protections and beyond. The New York Times actually had a recent, like, sexy piece talking about the rent revolution that is to come, and it was profiling KC Tenants in Kansas City, which is an amazing organization. Absolutely. On the policy side, we're seeing the adoption of new rent control and just cause protections all across the country. In California, we've had half a dozen cities adopt rent control in just the last year. In 2019, New York passed the biggest expansion of rent control in many years. In the Twin Cities, voters approved rent control, strong rent control, over the last couple of years, even though they were then watered down by their horrible city councilors and their mayors vote them out. Even Orange County in Florida recently voted for rent control. But of course, their failing presidential candidate of a governor, Ron DeSantis, then stopped the whole effort. Within the Debt Collective, our analysis of modern capitalism has always taken into account the role of debt and debt financing to the housing crisis. From the subprime mortgage crisis, which was a process of mass dispossession of people of color, to the rent-driven eviction crisis of tenants today. Our debt analysis understands tenants' unions to be a kind of debtor's union, because what is a missed or late rent payment if not a form of debt? The difference with housing, though, as opposed to other forms of debt, is that the failure to pay this debt has crushing, often extremely violent, and I could talk a lot about violent examples of this, but often violent and painfully swift repercussions for debtors. Default and repossession for homeowners, mass evictions for tenants, whether it's legal or illegal, right? Extrajudicial. In that debt, though, as Astra already mentioned, there's a lot of like latent power, because the power that organized tenants hold when or wield over landlords is the power to withhold rents until their demands are met, the rent strike. 3 years ago, as the pandemic kind of really kicked off, Hannah Appel, a colleague and co-founder of the Debt Collective, she read a paper by Gary Blasi, the man, the myth, the legend, a longtime social justice lawyer in California, where he really kind of explained what the crisis looked like for tenants during the pandemic, which meant if we don't adopt some stridently strong protections right now, there's going to be a tsunami of evictions. And he specifically emphasized the procedural difficulties that California renters faced when going to trial. Even in progressive California, the law is almost comically pro-landlord. Under California law, tenants only who are served eviction papers by the court only have 5 days to prepare and file a very complex answer. If they don't, they face a default judgment, which means that they automatically lose their trial. In fact, they lose their case without even going to trial. About half the tenants in California, by the way, lose this way. That's 200,000 people every single year who lose in this way. So drawing on the lessons of our defense to repayment tool that the Debt Collective created for student debt, and in conjunction with the LA Tenants Union, UCLA Luskin Institute on Inequality and Democracy, and the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project, we released the Tenant Power Toolkit in July last year. It basically is an online legal mutual aid tool that allows tenants to be able to file an answer to their evictions. It actually goes like really comprehensively into your defenses. It does it by like interviewing you, asking you basic questions, and then it spits out a super comprehensive, super detailed answer that you are then able to file at court. And in LA County, you can do it electronically from literally your computer, which is amazing. Since July of last year, we've had about 5,000 answers filed, intervening and preventing 10,000 people or more from actually being evicted automatically. It's now responsible for 1 out of every 5 answers that is being filed in the county, which is incredible. But this is not the end, and I will wrap up now. Through the toolkit, we've been able to build an eviction data set of extraordinary detail. Using this data, we've started to provide key insights on the eviction crisis for advocacy campaigns on rent debt and eviction protections in California. We've also identified the biggest evictors in our data set, which, given what we're learning that the biggest evictors are also among the top or the largest landlords nationally. So we're asking ourselves now, and this is where I'm going to cut off, you know, can we build a campaign and a coalition of organizations that is broad and deep in the way that we built around student debt? And all of you are part of different organizations in this room, so this is a clarion call to all of you. Can we build a campaign to go after these folks, maybe even one day to expropriate them? And I'm going to end right there.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. and don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.